This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Mad Genius, A Manifesto for Entrepreneurs. This is the author, Randy Gage. What is it about genius that tortures so many who possess it? A mad genius, if ever there was one, Hunter S. Thompson, was asked how he created his unique brand of brilliance. His reply was inspired, if a little unnerving. "I hate to advocate drugs, alcohol, violence, or insanity to anyone, but they've always worked for me." I wish I could say the muse for this book was a sudden inspiration of genius, but it was actually germinated in an environment of shame and wretched despair. Shame because I was lying around my apartment trying to throw off the after effects of a binge relapse with crystal meth, an addiction I thought I had long ago conquered. And despair because the euphoria of the high, which of course gets less euphoric every time, was replaced by the exhaustion, nausea, and depression of the crash. Among meth addicts, these days are called Suicide Tuesdays for reasons you can probably imagine. Now, if you think that seems like a less than opportune environment to foster creative genius, you're only half right. Because sometimes it's when we're at our lowest state, facing our most difficult challenges, that we pull ourselves together, marshal our resources, and decide that the alternative to hopelessness is actually hope after all. You're going to find this is a recurring theme in this manifesto. Why no is never the answer, failure isn't final unless you quit, and how challenges offer the greatest opportunities for innovation and creation. Obviously, this relapse was one more chapter of the twisted hero's journey that my subconscious mind felt necessary to create for myself to overcome my own insecurities and worthiness issues. The good news is, I believe this won't happen again. Sometimes you just know when you're done. I felt that way after I took my last drink on my 20th birthday and 35 years later never had another desire for another one. And just as I felt my life worked better without alcohol in it, I now feel that recreational drug use doesn't enrich my life, but destroys it. So I chose life. But I also had this unnerving pang. Could I still write, or would the goddess of creativity abandon me at the altar? Would I still possess the gift to recognize opportunities and build entrepreneurial ventures? I grew up watching creative geniuses like Joplin, Hendrix, and Morrison blaze brilliantly, then die of overdoses. And I idolize writers like Hemingway, Poe, O. Henry, and of course Thompson, who all viewed drugs and alcohol as necessary ingredients for their creative genius, or at least helpful to medicate the issues preventing them from achieving it. Fortuitously, I read On Writing, the brilliant memoir of the craft of writing from Stephen King, who recounted his ability to face down his own addiction demons and still create. I began to think that a look at genius and how we harness, nurture, and direct it would make for a fascinating book. And even more intriguing would be an exploration specifically of how the mindset of the entrepreneurial genius works. Funny, as I was reading up on the links between creativity and mental illness, I found a Wikipedia entry that stated, "Psychotic individuals are said to display a capacity to see the world in a novel and original way. Literally, to see things that others cannot." Now, entrepreneurs are not psychotic, of course. We simply display a capacity to see the world in a novel and original way, literally to see things that others cannot. Oh, wait. As entrepreneurs, we're hardwired to shake things up, live by our own set of rules, and more importantly, create new things. Our greatest genius comes in the creation part. That's the reason we watch the Steve Jobs product launches with breathless anticipation, why we care more about the commercials than the Super Bowl, and why we're almost giddy when we come across the Kickstarter campaign for a sexy new gadget. We're witnessing genius in action. So I was pondering all this, and I happened to be watching Before Night Falls, the magnificent film that was based on the stunning book by Reynaldo Arenas, One Genius Showcasing the Gifts of Another. And when you're exposed to a film or book like these, you can't help but want to create something amazing, something that makes a difference. So this manifesto that I'm reading you right now comes to you from one of the lowest points in my life, but I hope leads us both to reach something much, much higher, harnessing your mad genius and sharing that mad genius with the world. And I hope you'll join me with the discussion on social media. Use the hashtag #MadGenius. You'll find this manifesto is divided into three sections. Book one is a look at how we got to where we are now, how the convergence of bad premise, negative memes, and herd thinking infected our consciousness and allowed us to accept mediocrity. Book two explores some of the earth-shattering, cataclysmic developments we'll be facing in the upcoming decade. We'll peek around the corner, predict the future, recognize the inherent challenges in that future, which will, of course, reveal to us the greatest opportunities. And finally, Book 3 is a chaotic collection of mind-bending, thought-provoking ideas to force you to think about what you think about. Listen to whichever section you need at the point you need it. But know that there is one constant in all three sections, the real world truth about how you have to think to become a successful entrepreneur. Inspirational business book authors may claim to play different tunes, but most of them are singing the same song, which is ever-growing success. The case studies all seem to follow the same template. Couple of college kids with nothing but some empty beer cans and pizza boxes littering their dorm rooms have a big idea. They drop out of school, set up shop, and become an overnight viral sensation. They get to choose from a swarm of VC investors who desperately want to throw money at them, ignore calls from Mark Zuckerberg, float an IPO, become billionaires, and grace the cover of Wired. Some of the readers who buy these books must wonder what they're doing wrong. In the real world of business, though, there are both breathtaking breakthroughs and soul-wrenching failures. It's a world with fears and doubts, sweating to make payroll, scrambling to raise money, struggling to stand out. I'm here to tell you that getting on top and staying on top is never a sure thing. But if you're willing to do the work and pay the price, success is attainable. It's never easy, but it's worth it. Book one, The Mysterious People and the Secret System That Runs the World. Put yourself in this picture. We were on Mo Orea in French Polynesia, often known as the Tahitian Islands, at a luxurious resort where the bungalows are suspended over the water with a hatch on the floor so you can feed the fish underneath. There were 10 of us sitting around a conference table loaded with tropical fruit, fresh-squeezed juice, and coffee. The morning sun was streaming in, the weather was sublime, and the environment was perfect for a brilliant brainstorming session. The other 9 people had paid $15,000 each and flown thousands of miles to have a 3-day mastermind retreat with me. I began the session by going around the table, asking everyone to summarize the one big concept they would like to strategize during the retreat. The first guy said he wanted to do a complete makeover of his website. The second person said she needed help with a title for her next book. The third person mentioned that he wanted some input on his next direct mail campaign. It went on like this until it came around back to me. But before I go any further, if you really were around that table in Mo'orea right now, what would you say? Take a minute and really think about it. Because here's what happened next. I closed my eyes, took a slow, deep breath, and said, I'm going to the fucking pool now. When you guys decide you want to actually have a mastermind and go after a big idea, then somebody come and get me. Not sure what was said next, but after about 10 minutes, one sheepish attendee came out and asked if I would rejoin the group. So what happened? Herd thinking happened. Like so often occurs in many situations, the person going first set the tone, and everybody just followed after that unthinkingly, shadowing the pattern. Of course, the interesting dynamic in this case was that these nine people were not random souls picked up at the bus stop. They were all hyper-successful, multimillionaire entrepreneurs who had invested a lot of money and time to be there to discover their next breakthrough. You probably think they wouldn't fall prey to such disempowering thinking. But how did you reply when I asked you that question? Was your answer really a big, bold, and breathtaking concept you wanted to mastermind on? Or did you also default to some mundane tactic? Even high achievers are not immune to being infected with herd thinking when they're a member of a group. You see the same scenario if you start a meeting by asking people to go around the room and give their name and title so everyone knows who's who. If the first person says, Aldo Gonzalez, Vice President of Quality Control, everybody follows suit, your objective is accomplished, and you get down to work. However, if the first person says, Thanks, it's so great to be here. My name is Mary Marcus, and I flew in from the Toronto division. My hobbies are embroidery and stamp collecting, and I'm really excited to be at this conference because I was just telling my sister last week, blah, 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 blah. You know immediately you're screwed. The intros that you budgeted 5 minutes for will actually eat up 25 or 45 minutes of the 90 minutes you have. The herd doesn't always follow the leader. Sometimes they simply follow whoever speaks first. These examples illustrate a very important lesson about our thought processes, showing how often we go on autopilot and waste the amazing brain power we possess. In the case of my South Pacific retreat, the first person made a mistake in his thinking, a mistake many other entrepreneurs fall prey to, believing success to be about the tactics. But the genuinely important stuff is never about the tactics. It's actually about the big idea. When you get the big idea right, the tactics become readily apparent. To truly harness your mad genius, you have to resist the urge to begin with tactics. You have to first step back and do some critical thinking. What is the desired outcome here? Who is the real target market? What are the actual benefits for the people in the target group? What's the big idea? What is the story that will communicate the big idea? Very few entrepreneurs, and shockingly, even very few large successful companies, take the time to really do this. For evidence, look no further than the literally billions of examples of horrible marketing we churn out week after week. No matter what kind of business you're in, sales and marketing are the engines that drive it. Every entrepreneur and every manager who wants to think like an entrepreneur has to at least be cognizant of what good marketing is and isn't. Yet it's alarming how many entrepreneurs, many who are bright, bold, and innovative, lose their ability for critical thinking, discernment, and even rationality when it comes to marketing. Many are totally ignorant of the subject, fobbing it off on someone else in the organization if they're able to, or else an outside ad agency hoping for the best. The amount of dull, ineffective, and just plain ridiculous advertising out there is mind-numbing. Even worse, the biggest offenders are some of the largest brands in the world. You would think with huge creative teams and even bigger budgets, they'd be delivering a compelling, benefit-centered message targeted to their best prospects. But if I've learned one universal truth about marketing, it is this. The bigger the budget, the more stupid shit will get green-lighted. A perfect example of this is beer advertising. This is a massive market with literally billions of dollars spent in this category, which means you'll see some of the most insipid, off-target, and downright wasteful advertising anywhere. Although you have to give creative points to Anheuser-Busch for having the chutzpah to promote themselves as America's local brewery, since these days the multi-billion dollar conglomerate is actually owned by Belgian company InBev. We don't want to scan a code to see who was working on the assembly line the day our beer was bottled. And if your unique selling proposition is a wide hole in the top of the can, you probably should go back to the well and try again. Likewise, if you think the most exciting thing about your beer is that I can punch an extra hole in the can with a can opener so the beer flows faster? Seriously? Can you imagine sitting in on the creative meeting where the big idea for the campaign was one of these things? Or how about the meeting where they had the brilliant concept to shape the can like a keg? And how many beer drinkers do you think were lying awake at night wishing their can would change colors to tell them if it was cold? Can't you tell that already when you're holding it? All of these multi-million and multi-billion dollar campaigns missed the mark because they were created with a tactical approach instead of first finding the big idea. And of course, when you're really brilliant, the big idea will be centered not around the amazing features of your product or service, but around the amazing benefits it provides the customer. It's just human nature that when we're asked to market something, we default to listing its features. If I give you a widget to sell, it seems logical to describe its color, size, and the material it's made of. But do that and you've fallen prey to herd thinking. No one really cares about the features of your drill bit. They just want a hole in their wall. You have to go the next step and think about exactly what the widget will do for the prospect, the delightful joy it will bring her when she gets it, or the cataclysmic consequences she will suffer if she doesn't buy it. The big idea should be the thing that grabs attention, attracts the tribe, or speaks directly to the prospect, but in the context of the benefit to her. It should be the mechanism in the copy platform that pulls things together, creates the story arc, and pulls the prospect through the message to reach the desired conclusion. It's great if you have Kevin Durant in your Sprint commercial. But with no big idea, it's just him talking to a goofy kid in a treehouse dream sequence, and it has no relation to the message of the campaign. It's almost as pointless as the millions of dollars that beef jerky company spends on their nonsensical messing with Sasquatch commercials. The fact that your car has a push-button start is not a big idea to base a campaign on. Neither is the fact that your minivan has a foot-activated hatch. These hint at potential benefits, but they're still just minor features and certainly not important enough to base entire campaigns on, which several automakers have done. Going back to Sprint, over the last couple of years, they've had some of the craziest and questionable advertisements of any major brand. You remember those commercials with James Earl Jones and Malcolm McDowell dramatizing text messages? The first one was clever and showed some potential, but then they got downright creepy. And creepy is way too kind of a word to describe the Framley campaign they were running as I wrote this book, featuring that family with the, it was like a French-speaking daughter and a father played by a gerbil in a fishbowl with a Yiddish accent. What the fuck? What I wouldn't have given to be in that creative meeting and heard the logic behind that. Sometimes the big idea is little. I was working out at my gym the other day when I noticed one of the physical therapists had set up his massage table in the middle of the gym. He leaned a whiteboard against it and he had written these words, "Tell me what hurts." Now, how's that for intriguing the prospect, grabbing attention, and creating a compelling headline? Turns out his name was Ryan, and he specializes in assisted myofascia release. I asked what it could do for my herniated disc, hoping to prolong my legendary, in my own mind at least, softball career. Ryan suggested he might be able to release some tension around the disc that was causing pain to radiate down my legs, and he offered to test some techniques on me. He did a 10-minute treatment, after which I immediately signed up for a series of 5 sessions at $95 each. You may be thinking that Ryan's whiteboard and free sample idea won't scale for a big business like yours. But I bet with a little critical thinking, you could find a way to adapt something similar. And I would wager Ryan booked more real business as a result of his zero-cost 2-hour campaign of leaning his whiteboard against the massage table than Sprint booked with $5 million worth of those ridiculous talking gerbil commercials. And even if you can't replicate what Ryan did, you can build your marketing around a prospect-centered, benefit-driven platform. And you can have a big idea or theme that pulls everything together. Now, marketing is just one of the areas you can fall victim to herd thinking. It's just as easy to disengage your critical thinking gear when evaluating potential markets, assessing new opportunities, and developing innovative new products. And in lots of other areas, too. The good news is, once you really develop your mad genius, you'll stop falling into habitual thinking and always approach every situation as a critical thinker, seeing possibilities instead of believing in the big lie. Ask any 100 people what the opposite of success is, and 99 will probably answer failure. But that's the big lie. The real opposite of success is not failure, but mediocrity. Not only is failure not the opposite of success, it's actually an integral and necessary element of success. There has never been a goal worthy of achieving that didn't warrant some failures along the way. In fact, the greater the chance and degree of failure, the more astonishing any potential achievement can ultimately be. Failures are not dead-end outcomes, unless you quit and then you've ended the story. The entrepreneur who doesn't make mistakes doesn't make anything. The fastest way to a disruptive breakthrough today is experimentation and failing fast. Failures are simply momentary challenges. When you persevere through them, these challenges become the stepping stones to your success. They allow you to learn lessons, modify strategies, and develop the necessary character to become a successful entrepreneur. The other big misconception about entrepreneurial success concerns money, or more precisely, the lack of it. Many studies show the biggest cause of business failure is undercapitalization. And most entrepreneurs bemoan their inability to get financing and attract investors. But in reality, no one has a money shortage. What they really suffer from is an idea shortage. There are billions of dollars, pounds, pesos, euros, and rubles all over the world, desperately looking for projects to invest in, causes to support, and solutions to buy right now. The only thing between you and the money you're seeking or the outcome you wish to create is the right idea. So this is a manifesto about ideas. Big ideas, small ideas, and outlandish ideas. Ideas that innovate, ideas that disrupt markets, and especially ideas that irritate. Deeper than ideas, though, this book is about how ideas are born and the role they play in entrepreneurial thinking and the kinds of thinking that will be required from both you and me as we enter the most exciting time in human history. We'll explore conventional thinking, logical thinking, lateral thinking, and creative thinking, and how we mix them all together to create mad genius. This is a manifesto for managers who want to become leaders, and leaders prepared to lead in an age of exponential disruption. Because whether you work in a traditional business, run a nonprofit service organization, or are a government official managing a department, the best way to create fresh and innovative solutions is to think like an entrepreneur, which is where we will begin. Creating art. Entrepreneurship is artistry because we create entities that have never existed before. Like all true artists, we don't create our art for the money or the fame. We create our art because we have to. We have no problem becoming the next dot-com billionaire, gracing the cover of Fast Company, but we do what we do whether it made us rich or not. There's a void in our psyche that can only be filled when we're solving challenges, designing solutions, developing products, opening markets, innovating processes, and creating jobs. This is a yearning that not all people feel. In fact, most people don't. Most people who go to work are happy to fit in, look competent, and not get fired. When they set out to create something, whether it's a pizza parlor, a sci-fi screenplay, or a boutique advertising agency, they try their hardest to fit in with the others in their space. True entrepreneurs and the visionary employees who think like them aren't interested in following the pack. They have to lead the pack, not for ego or status, simply because they can't operate any other way. Ultimately, this manifesto is a call for leadership, for new and fresh ideas on the way we create art. More specifically, it's a call to develop a thinking process that produces the disciplines of art we call innovation, market disruption, breakthrough products, brilliant marketing, industry reinvention, and iconic branding. It will require that you go outside yourself and become the thinker of the thought, recognizing, analyzing, and quantifying the cognitive process that successful entrepreneurs use to create the outcomes that only we can create. It takes the mindset of possibility, of never saying no, and being open to where the art takes us. It's a lesson I learned personally from the mad watchmaker. Back in the late 90s, maybe early 2000s, I was conducting a business congress in Central Europe with Nicholas Hayek, the founder of the Swatch Group. At that time, Hayek was probably in his, mid-70s, had single-handedly rescued the entire Swiss watch industry, and was a billionaire at least four times over. Not that any of that had mellowed him any. We were conducting a press conference to promote the event when a young reporter asked Hayek when he was planning on retiring. Hayek looked at him as though the man had called his mother a whore. And then in his gruff, irascible style, he proclaimed, "Entrepreneurs are artists, and artists never retire." At that very moment, I was struck by two fundamental truths. Number one, I knew I would spend the rest of my life wishing I had been the first person in the world to utter those words. And number two, I now had a label to define my angst. Hayek never did retire, by the way. He died unexpectedly of cardiac failure while busy at work in the Swatch corporate headquarters in 2010. I had tried to retire once when I was 40 and had my first midlife crisis, right? I thought I would do nothing but play softball, race cars, and drink out of coconuts. That lasted 9 months. The inactivity drove me crazy, so I got back in the game. I never understood why I needed to be back in the game, but the instant Hayek made that declaration, I knew. The entrepreneur as artist. Seth Godin's book, The Icarus Deception, is a brilliant take on the role of artistry in being an entrepreneur. And Stephen Pressfield's magnificent book, Turning Pro, Tap Your Inner Power and Create Your Life's Work, also offers some great insights into the fascinating intersection of creative genius and the everyday work world. One fundamental truth that underscores both books is that entrepreneurial artists don't solve problems as much as they reveal or create possibilities. More about this in a bit. Think of all the memes we have circulating in the world about art today, from starving artists to writer's block, from appreciated only after death to tortured genius. The parallels with entrepreneurs are many. Like the writer hunched over a keyboard, staring at the flashing cursor, an entrepreneur trying to make a payroll might occupy the loneliest place on earth. Admittedly, entrepreneurs won't usually cut off an ear like Van Gogh did. We're much more neurotic than that. Having a dream, raising capital, employee issues, doubt from family and friends, getting to market, the market yawning, employee issues, skepticism from your peers, making payroll, product development, employee issues, growing pains, jealousy from family and friends, attacks from the media, branding concerns, cash flow problems, employee issues, inventory nightmares, government regulations. Oh, did I mention employee issues? It takes vision to see something that hasn't been invented yet. It takes guts to go after that vision in the face of doubt, criticism, and even ridicule. It takes resiliency to stay the course in meager times. Being an entrepreneur requires a mindset that few possess because bringing a concept to market, it's as much an emotional roller coaster as writing For Whom the Bell Tolls, sculpting David, or composing La Bohème. See the intangible. When something has never existed before, it's not uncommon for it to be misunderstood, misinterpreted, and misconstrued. If you come upon a mother of dragons speaking Dothraki, and you've never encountered such a thing before, your inability to correctly process what is in front of your eyes can deceive you. This misguided perception can cause you to miss opportunities or even sabotage your own success. How do you describe chocolate to somebody who's never tasted it? Explain green to a blind person, or depict Motley Crue to a deaf one. You might have an easier time trying to explain reincarnation to a giraffe. There was a time when Amazon.com was a ridiculous idea, until the moment it became a brilliant one. There was a time when MySpace was a concept of genius, until it became a flop, and perhaps could become something significant again. Facebook was a hit, then a dud, then took over the world, at least for now. Innovation and other breakthrough ideas come about from a higher level of thinking than problem-solving or even anticipating trends. Innovation and true breakthrough concepts come about only when we have the courage to go back to a blank canvas and envision a reality that has never existed before. This is mad genius. This is never saying no and seeing only possibilities. The Dodge Viper was created from a dramatically higher level of thinking than the Chrysler K car was. It's a form of thinking that isn't taught in MBA programs, and you don't find it in many C-suites. Unfortunately, both the academic and corporate environments are chiseled into reactive, backward-looking thinking. You can't get to where you want to go by thinking that way. You've got to escape the herd thinking and unleash your mad genius. I get you're not like most people. You wouldn't have bought this manifesto if you were. Yet I seriously doubt you are aware of the awesome magnitude of innate genius you already possess. You bought into the lies, limiting beliefs, and negative memes. You settled. You believe that other people have genius and you are just you. But if I've learned anything in 25 years of working with leaders, it's this. Everyone has the gift of genius, including you. But genius is not something you find. It's a process you develop. It's a circuitous, mysterious, and often unsettling process. So I'm here to unsettle you. Decide where to reside. Man, genius starts with a decision. The decision to tap your genius is about thinking in new and different ways. It happens when you refuse to accept no and decide to find a way, even when there isn't a way. Mad genius also is dramatically affected by the neighborhood you choose to hang out in. Now, I'm not talking about the street you live on, but the region where you park your mind. And try as you might, you can't live in two places at once. Here are the possibilities. Mediocrity. This is where most people live. There's a serious overpopulation issue here. Good. Less populated, but still very crowded. No one will criticize you for living here. In fact, most of your neighbors will graciously welcome you to the neighborhood and encourage you to stay. Then there's great. Real estate values are high in this neighborhood. Lots of people want to live here, but few actually do. And finally, there's mad genius. This is the place where the elite artists in any profession hang out. It's a members-only club, but there's no invitation. You qualify for the club just because you decide to. You knock on the door of opportunity, and if it doesn't answer, you kick in the goddamn door. The price you pay. If you want to tap into the innate brilliance that you possess and lead an organization that produces mad genius results, you have to be willing to take risks and be willing to fail. And I'm not talking about having your third quarter profit results off by a few percentage points. I'm talking about doing something everyone says you can't do and then having everyone watch you not do it. Because even an epic failure as painful as that is, lets you know you're in the game and you're playing at a world-class level. Steve Jobs is idolized for being this innovative, creative genius, and he certainly was. But don't forget the serious failures and missteps he had along the way. In reality, it was his willingness to fail that ultimately led him to succeed at such breathtaking levels. Did you know that when Jobs died, he was the single largest shareholder of Disney? That's where his greatest wealth came from, not Apple. After he was fired from Apple in 1985, something that was probably the right decision from Apple's point of view, one of the two companies he founded was Pixar. Took Pixar nearly a decade to bring out its first film, the first all-digitally animated film, but its eventual sale to Disney made Jobs more than just a board member. It made him a billionaire. If you want to do something epic, you must be willing to face challenges, some of which will temporarily defeat you. But those challenges are the stepping stones that help you modify your strategies, gain new knowledge, and develop the character traits to become great. No one ever had a momentous breakthrough in their comfort zone, and you won't be the first. Be willing to pay the price. Who picked salt and pepper? Why are salt and pepper the only two seasonings available in almost every restaurant and dinner table in the Americas? Why not sea salt, paprika, or chili powder? And why just two choices and not three or five? Who says the North Pole is on the top? Most people I talk to seem to think so. But if I look from my apartment in Sydney, I can tell you for certain the South Pole is definitely on top. In reality, the top is relative to what angle you're viewing the Earth from the galaxy. So what if Einstein was wrong? Probably the most quoted statement from Albert Einstein is the quip defining insanity as doing the same thing yet expecting different results. But of course, Socrates cautioned us about believing everything we read on the internet. That insanity quote that everybody attributes to Einstein actually came out of a Narcotics Anonymous pamphlet that was published more than 30 years ago, and it's been attributed to a lot of people ever since, including Einstein. And while it was great advice back then, or even recently, it no longer is. And the reason why? The rules have changed. Today's marketplace changes by the second. The entire world is in constant change. Doing the same thing and expecting to get the same results today is insane. Yet most entrepreneurs and companies are still locked into that old paradigm. Today's fast-shifting, technology-driven world requires doing new and different things. And the only way to change the way you do things is to change the way you think about them. No matter what field you're in, there always seems to be a usual way of doing things, accepted practices, and conventional beliefs. But how often are conventional beliefs simply an excuse to avoid the really difficult work of critical thinking? Instead of following accepted premises, you got to question them. Doing this expands the bandwidth of your brain to be open to think in new and different direction. There are millions of people who can tell you why something won't work. You have to discover how it can work. The greatest killer of creativity and innovation is our predisposition to want to keep things the way they are. We like things known to us and comfortable. And of course, we can be stymied because that's the way it's always been done. But when you leave something the same, you're actually subjecting it to a great deal of change. Paint a fence white and leave it alone, it'll eventually turn gray. Leave it alone long enough and it will end up black. no object, or for that matter, any policy, method, or best practice, operates in a vacuum. Even things left alone are subject to the influences of the changing environment around them. Volcanoes create new islands, markets change, muscles atrophy, earth settles, relationships change, economies change, and people die. The average age of companies on the original Fortune 500 list in 1955 was 75 years. Today, the average is 10. 10 years from now, I expect that number will be fewer than 5. Even the most brilliant ideas become obsolete if left static long enough. So the real questions to consider are these. What other conventional wisdom have you automatically accepted because they said it was so? And who the hell are they anyway? As an entrepreneur, you have to change the default setting you've probably been programmed with. Probably no, that won't work, and reset it to a new mindset, never say no. The amount of deprogramming that requires cannot be underestimated, which takes us to the real identity of they. The mysterious people in charge of the secret system that runs the world. You're probably wondering, who are these mysterious people and how does this system eviscerate innovation, free thinking, and common sense? The story begins simply enough when I was waiting in the taxi line at London's Heathrow Airport. Peter, the cab driver who ended up getting my fare, had been waiting in the taxi lot for almost 2 hours. I, along with most of almost 100 other people, had been standing in the aforementioned taxi stand in the bone-chilling London weather for more than 20 minutes waiting for a cab. Now, perhaps you're wondering why I and millions of other travelers who land at Heathrow have to endure this wait in this frigid UK winter. The reason is mysterious people in charge of the secret system that runs the world. Here's how this system works. One employee is hired to stand at the front of the queue and instruct us to wait there until there's at least 40 people freezing in the cold. Another employee is hired to walk back and forth in front of the line, receiving abuse from cold, irate people who are wondering, why don't they just call some taxis? The first employee then radios for 4 taxis to arrive from the 500 that have been idling for hours at the airport waiting for a fare. The first employee instructs the cold people to wait. The second employee walks along the cab stand and verifies that the 4 taxis that have arrived are actually taxis. Then employee 1 asks the first party in line where they're going and points them to cab 1. He does the same for the second, third, and fourth parties, directing each one to a cab. The second employee walks up and down the line, receiving abuse from the cold, irate people who are wondering why don't they call more taxis. The line of cold people has now grown to more than 100. Employee 1 radios for 4 more taxis from the 500 that have been idling for hours at the airport waiting for a fare, and the process repeats itself over and over again. Perhaps you think this process is counterproductive and dysfunctional. Perhaps you think it could be facilitated much more simply. But then you would be questioning the mysterious people in charge of the secret system that runs the world. More about that in a minute. When I finally make it to the front of the line, employee 1 asks me where I'm going and directs me to cab 1, which of course happens to be Peter. That's when he admits to me he's frustrated at having to wait 2 hours to get a fare, but he's resigned himself to accepting this status quo, no doubt because it's dictated by the secret system that runs the world. Now, perhaps you're thinking this taxi system is an anomaly because it's likely designed by government bureaucrats who would think in a way diametrically opposed to entrepreneurs the way they would, or the creative thinking you would expect from entrepreneurs. And you believe such an instance could never take place in the free enterprise environment. But what happened next when I arrived at my London hotel proves the depth of this insidious conspiracy of the mysterious people. Once comfortably ensconced in my hotel room, I power up my laptop and check my email. I've received a message, which I'm pretty sure is spam, promoting a conference. So my first thought is not to click it, because I hate to reward spam. But I'm always looking to sharpen my saw and attend events where I can learn. So I click through, because this is a marketing conference, and I go to their website. The conference is only a few months away, so you'd think the lineup would be pretty set. But no sessions or presenters are listed. No speakers' bios in the bio section. I clicked the tab for opening keynote and found a page listing, will be announced at a later date. The only sessions that are actually listed are pre-event cocktail party, opening cocktail party, mid-event cocktail party, and closing cocktail party. Probably at this point you think this is a conference created for alcoholics. But no, this is not an alcoholic conference. It's a conference about marketing. The site doesn't even list the price for the event. All you can learn is that the price is $300 less if you join the association, which is obviously run by the mysterious people conducting the event. And guess what organization is promoting this marketing conference that actually doesn't have any actual marketing? It's an organization called the Direct Response Marketing Alliance. Perhaps you're wondering how an organization that doesn't know the first thing about direct marketing could be running a conference on direct marketing. But that's just the way it works in the secret system that runs the world. You see where we're going with all this, right? Of course, I elect not to put down my credit card for the marketing conference. I wake up the next day, fly to Kiev, give my speech in the morning, and fly back to London, where this time, of course, I've arranged a car and driver. The next morning, I head back to Heathrow for my British Airways flight to California. Since I've again arranged a car and driver, and he seemed to be training for the Formula One series, I arrived at the airport almost 2 hours before my flight. And since I'm a savvy road warrior, I rock up to the security line with my pre-printed boarding pass and carry-on luggage, but my boarding pass doesn't work. Cue the sinister Darth Vader theme music here. The boarding pass doesn't work because BA hasn't checked my documents yet. Probably you think that's what the UK Border Patrol is for, but that's not the way it works in the secret system. They prefer the airline ticket clerks, highly trained in security and border patrol, check the documents instead of the actual border patrol. So I go to the BA counter to get my passport verified. The clerk says, "I see the problem. It's because we changed the equipment." I inquire about the configuration in the front cabin. Turns out it's the same as the original plane. So I want to know, why can't I have the same seat? She can't assign me a seat, however, because the secret system that runs the world has been invoked, and no agents can issue any seats for 30 minutes. So I ask if she can give me a temporary boarding pass so I can get through security and wait in the Concorde lounge. She says it cannot be done. Now think in your best Yoda voice. Always with you, it cannot be done, right?